أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الحمد لله وبه نستعين والصلاة والسلام على سيد المرسلين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. First of all, I just want to thank people for thank you all for inviting me. This is sort of introductory talk because hadith is often, I remember when I first became Muslim and I started learning about hadith, I always would ask questions about hadith and people would say, you know, brother, don't even think about it. It's too complicated. Don't even try. It's just such a deep science. You'll never understand it. Don't even think about it. So I said, okay, well, I guess I shouldn't learn about hadith. And then when I went to graduate school, alhamdulillah, there were actually some older students who were studying hadith, and they sort of introduced me to how to start learning about hadith and studying with teachers and things like that, and reading sort of introductory books. And I started learning, and I found it's actually not that difficult a science. In fact, hadith is a very common sense science. It's a very common sense tradition, and something that Muslims should be very proud of. And I have no problem saying this. I say it very, very confidently as a scholar that the hadith tradition in Islam is one of the biggest accomplishments in human intellectual history. It's just a tremendous accomplishment in terms of its breadth and its depth and its complexity and its internal consistency. And it's something that Muslims should be very proud of, and something Muslims should be happy to learn about, even if they're just starting out, because as the famous Chinese saying says, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. So hopefully this will just be a very short introduction to some of the history of hadith collection and the purposes of hadith in Islamic civilization. The first question is, what is a hadith? Very simple question. What is a hadith? Hadith is a statement of the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, a communication about an action the Prophet did, alayhi salatu wasalam, or something that was done in his presence to which he did not object. Something done in his presence to which he did not object. We'll talk about examples of these in a second. I think we've all know examples of sayings of the Prophet. For example, إِنَّمَا الْعَمَالُ بِالنِّيَاتِ. All deeds are judged by intentions. Right? Things that the Prophet did. How did he pray? Right? Reports about how he prayed, about how he fasted, about how he sat, about how he drank. Right? Things that were done in his presence. That people ate lizard in his presence. And he didn't say that this is wrong. If he didn't say it's wrong, it must be right. So these are the three types of hadiths. Sayings, actions, and things done in his presence to which he did not object. Every hadith consists of two things. It consists of an isnad and the metin. What is the isnad? The isnad is the chain of transmission for that metin. The metin is the actual text of the hadith. So those examples I just gave, for example, إِنَّمَا الْعَمَالُ بِالنِّيَاتِ, all deeds are judged by intentions. This is the metin of the hadith, the actual saying, statement of the Prophet. Or if I said, the Prophet used to walk in this way, that would be the metin of the hadith, describing what the Prophet did. The isnad is the chain of transmission by which we know that hadith. So for example, the hadith of all deeds are judged by intentions is narrated, let's say we'll take the Muwatta of Imam Malik, from Malik, from Yahya bin Sa'id al-Ansari, from Muhammad ibn Ibrahim, from Alqamah ibn Waqqas, from Omar ibn al-Khattab, who heard the Prophet say, all deeds are judged by intentions. So that's the isnad. And here I have some just examples of some hadiths that come from major hadith collections, Sunni hadith collections. This is from the famous Sahih of al-Bukhari, the Sahih of Muhammad ibn Ismail al-Bukhari. He says, it was narrated to us by Yusuf ibn Musa. It was narrated to us. Now Yusuf ibn Musa is saying, it was narrated to us by Abu Usama, who says, it was narrated to me by al-A'mash, from Khaythama, from the companion Adi ibn Hatim, who said that the Messenger of God, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, said, there is not one amongst you except that he will be spoken to directly by his Lord with no translator or any barrier separating them. In other words, on the Day of Judgment. So this is a very important hadith because it tells us actually about something that's going to happen on the Day of Judgment. It means that we're all going to come into direct contact with God on the Day of Judgment. Right? Here's a second hadith from a very famous Sunni hadith collection, the Sunan of Abu Dawood al-Sijistani. He says, it was narrated to us by Muhammad ibn Dawood ibn Sufyan, who says it was narrated to us by Yahya ibn Hassan, who said it was narrated to us by Sulaiman ibn Musa, who said it was narrated to us by Ja'far ibn Sa'd, We said it was narrated to me by Khubayb ibn Sulayman from his father, from the companion Samara ibn Jundub, who said in a speech, he was giving a speech, "Indeed the Messenger of God, may the peace and blessings of God be upon him, would order us to pay a charity on things we were preparing for sale." So this is very important because it helps us know about zakat. So if I'm preparing something for sale, let's say I'm producing something that I'm going to sell, like a saddle, let's say, or a saddle blanket, right? Maybe I'm almost finished, I'm going to get it ready to sell. I actually have to pay charity tax on these things. Or these things, the potential income, let's say. Actually, exactly how this, now that I think about it, exactly how this hadith would be interpreted is very complicated. I don't want to get into that because I know I'll make a mistake. This is from a less famous hadith collection. Somebody who died later than Bukhari and Abu Dawood. Someone named Abu al-Qasim Sulaiman al-Tabarani, who died in 971 of the Common Era, 360 of the Hijri calendar. He said it was narrated to us by Ahmed ibn Mansur al-Jindisapuri. It was narrated to him by Ali ibn Harb, and it was reported to him by Ash'ath ibn Attaf, from Abdullah ibn Habib, from a Sha'bi, from the companion Jabir ibn Abdullah, that the Messenger of God bought a camel from me and then let me ride it back into the city. So this hadith is interesting in two ways. One, it tells us about the character of the Prophet, which is that he's very generous and conscientious of other people's needs. And second, it says that you can sell something to somebody, and then you can actually use it after that. You know, maybe with that person's permission. There's nothing wrong with that, right? So it has ethical implications. It also has practical legal implications. These are just a few examples of hadiths the Prophet said. Another important thing to remember when we talk about hadith is that if you imagine I say something in this lecture, right? And then all of you leave the room and you all go back to your homes and your friends and your families, and you tell them about something I said. There's going to be a lot of different versions of what I said, right? Let's say I say, always be nice to your mother, right? Let's say Usman can go home and say, Dr. Jonathan said that it's very important to be nice to your mother. And Moiz can say, he said it's part of a Muslim's behavior to be nice to your mother, right? So you actually get different versions of the same report, even though the original report was only one thing. And all the different versions generally get the same meaning, although they might actually be some important shades of distinction, right? And this is the difference between a tradition and a narration. When we talk about a tradition, this is the general thing the Prophet said, alayhi salam. This is the general report he said. The narrations are the different manifestations and versions of that we find in the different hadith collections. So, here's an example of how complicated this can get. This is one hadith, right? Oh, this is way too small. There's no way you're going to be able to read it, is it? Okay, I'll read it to you then. So, don't worry about the details. You can just see the complexity. All these things, here's the Prophet here, all these are different chains of transmission that lead to different books. And you can see some of them go through the same people and then branch out later on. Some of them start from different companions. All these people heard the Prophet say something like, "Our Lord descends each night to the lowest level of heavens in the last third of the night and says, 'Who will call upon me that I may answer? Who will ask me that I may give? Who seeks my forgiveness that I may forgive them?'" There's another version which says, "Indeed, God bides his time until when a third of the night has passed, he descends to the lowest heaven and says, 'Is there anyone seeking forgiveness? Is there anyone seeking penance? Is there anyone seeking, etc., 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 until the dawn breaks?" Or another version says, "God descends to the lowest heaven during the second half or the last third of the night and says, 'Who will call upon me?'" So you have all these different versions, and they differ on when this actually happens. When does God descend? Is it during the first third of the night, or is it during the last third of the night, or is it during the second half of the night? But the general meaning is the same, which is God comes down closer to the human beings, and to answer the prayers of those people who stayed up awake at that time of night, right? So in general, if you stay up at night, God is going to be more attentive to your prayers because you've sort of demonstrated your piety and your commitment by doing this. Just to be clear, this doesn't mean that God actually physically moves. A lot of people understand this as meaning that God is coming closer to us in the sense that He's going to respond to our prayers, right? Sometimes these differences in narrations can have a big legal impact or a big impact in how we understand the value that the hadith is telling us or is teaching us. There's the most famous hadith is Man kadhaba alayya muta'ammidan falyatabawwa maqadahu minan nar. Whoever misrepresents me intentionally, let him prepare for himself a seat in hellfire. So the Prophet is saying, whoever lies about me intentionally, this is something that's going to send this person to hell. The most famous hadith. Depends on which scholar you ask. There's anywhere between 60 to 100 companions who narrated this hadith. So you can see on this chart, you have basically three companions who narrate this hadith. There's 100 companions. Then imagine how many branches go off from there. I mean, thousands and thousands of narrations of this hadith. Now, most of the versions, the version of Anas bin Malik and Abu Huraira and other companions, say, whoever lies about me intentionally, whoever misrepresents me intentionally. There's one version of the hadith, narrated by the companion Abdullah ibn Az-Zubair. It says, whoever misrepresents me, no mention of intention, let him prepare for himself a seat in hellfire. So you can see there's a big difference between this version and the other versions. Because that means that if I just accidentally misquote a hadith, or accidentally attribute something to the Prophet that he didn't say, that would actually earn me a seat in hellfire. Or that would be worthy of somebody who deserves to be in hell. So you can see that there's actually a big distinction between these differences. So between these different narrations. So I'm not trying to say that that these narrations, that because they're all reflections of some initial statement, original statement, that there's no differences. They're oftentimes very important differences. And so which version a scholar chooses can have a big legal impact or impact on theology or impact on the values we have as Muslims. But it's also very important because oftentimes you'll hear people say, that's a weak hadith, or that hadith's not reliable. But what are they talking about? For example, I can tell you that this hadith here is unreliable, that this one is unreliable, that this one is unreliable, that this one's unreliable. Oops. Oops. Now I'm way off in another land. But there's still this one here. There's still this narration. So it's very hadith science is very complicated because it's very tricky to figure out when something is not something the Prophet said, right? There are certain hadiths that everybody knows are made up. For example, there's a hadith that says a person from Africa, if they get hungry, they steal, and when they get full, they fornicate. This is completely made up. This is totally, totally made up. The Prophet never said this. No one ever said this. This was something that some racist made up and attributed to the Prophet because they wanted to promote their racist agenda. So these things are baseless, right? And there's whole books in hadith criticism that deal with these baseless hadiths. Just list them all. For example, there's and some of them have really nice meanings. There's another hadith that says, "Ra'sa kulli dhanbin hubb ad-dunya," or "Hubb ad-dunya ra'sa kulli khati'a," which is that the love of this earthly world is the beginning of every sin. This is true, right? This is very true. But it doesn't mean that the Prophet said it. We all hear wonderful things every day that the Prophet didn't say. It doesn't mean that they're not true. But there's also doesn't mean that it's a hadith, right? So, but the point is that when you get into hadiths that are found in hadith collections that Muslims deal with on a daily basis, it's a very difficult and very complicated thing to say, no, this is not a reliable hadith, because there are so many narrations of hadiths. You have to go back and make sure that each single one of them is not reliable in order to say that hadith in general is not reliable. This is another big question when we start thinking about hadith, which is, what is hadith as opposed to, we've all heard of sirah, the biography of the Prophet. We've all heard of tafsir, or Quranic commentary. And we've all heard of history, just the history of the caliphs, the history of the Umayyad caliphs, the history of the Abbasid caliphs, the history of the four rightly guided caliphs. So how does hadith fit in with these other genres of writing that we all know about? There's a couple of important distinctions. And I want to, this is a chart. I don't know if you guys can see this. I wish this were bigger. Maybe if I just push this back. Okay, I hope you... Basically, the title at the top says Sources of Sirah and Hadith. Now, when Islam began, when the career of the Prophet began, Arabs didn't have any written traditions. They didn't have a written tradition of history. They didn't have a written tradition of bureaucratic record keeping. There was no courts. There was no government administration. Arabs just had basically poetry, and they had genealogy, because that's basically all they cared. Their whole society was based around tribes. And who you were descended to and who you're related to had to do with who was obliged to protect you, who you owed debts of loyalty to, etc., etc. That's how society was organized. And of course, another thing they loved doing was having battles and fighting and raiding one another, and then writing poetry about how brave they were, about how generous they were, etc., etc. And so they would write poetry about this. So they had poetry and genealogy. So you can see down here that in pre-Islamic Arabia, you have genealogy and what they called Ayyam al-Arab, or the battle days of the Arabs. And these are the stories of kind of their poetry about, and their stories about different battles they'd fought against different tribes. Another thing, obviously, that was existing in the time of the Prophet was stories from Jewish lore, from the biblical tradition, from Christians, from Persians, and just from different Arabian religions around the time of the Prophet. So these were all, and the Quran drew on these. When the Quran talks about the story of Moses, when the Quran talks about the story of Noah, it doesn't tell you what happened. It assumes that the audience knows this stuff, because the Arabs at the time of the Prophet knew these stories. So when we look at the beginning of this timeline with the death of the Prophet here, here we have about 75 of the Hijra calendar. Here's about 150 of the Hijra calendar. Just to let you know, 150 is when Abu Hanifa died. It's also when the famous Ibn Ishaq died, the author of the Sirah that we all know about. So when you get up to about 150, which is 767 of the Common Era, that's when you have people like Abu Hanifa and Ibn Ishaq living. So when Islam began, there was this sort of explosion of intellectual activity amongst the Arabs. And they started taking those traditions they had about poetry and genealogy and developing out of them different sciences of history and genres of historical writing. So you can see here that there's, if I can find the mouse, there we go. These solid lines represent very strong, reliable chains of transmission. So somebody, a companion, told someone from the next generation, who told someone from the next generation, and all those people were sort of competent and knowledgeable and had good memories. So, and these dotted lines are less reliable chains of transmission. Maybe there's not even a chain of transmission. Just like when I say, you know, I heard something the other day. Well, who did I hear it from? What's the source? Or, you know, I read something on the internet. These are sort of unreliable chains of transmission, as opposed to, I watched the speaker, the White House spokesman, tell me exactly what President Obama's schedule is going to be. I know that's reliable, right? We know the source. We know the source is knowledgeable. I saw it with my own eyes. So these are kind of the difference in reliability. And both of these types of chains of transmission are actually, we can imagine, they're part of our daily lives, right? We deal with this two different types of information all the time in our daily lives. So a lot of information went into what became books of Maghazi, like the Maghazi of a scholar named Musa ibn Uqba, one of the first books of Maghazi. Maghazi are books about the campaigns of the Prophet and the companions, the early Islamic conquest. This is a direct descendant of those battle days of the Arabs. So the pre-Islamic Arabs love to talk about their battles against one another, and the Muslims say, well, now we're Muslims, so let's talk about the battles of the Prophet and the early companions and the early Muslim community. And some of these had, you know, unreliable chains of transmission. Some of them didn't have anything to do with the Prophet, and some of them were really important legal reports. So, you know, how does the Prophet divide up spoils of war? This is a big legal issue. You know, if you go and you capture a Muslim camp, an enemy camp in Central Asia, how do you divide up the spoils of war? You have to go back to the Prophet's precedent to figure that out. The stories about the Ansab, or genealogies of the Arabs, also became important. And these were set down in what's known as books of Ansab, or genealogy. like the Kitab al-Ninsab of Hisham ibn al-Kalbi, who died in about 204 of the Hijri calendar, or 820 of the Common Era. That's the same year that Imam al-Shafi'i died, by the way. So he's a contemporary of Imam al-Shafi'i. These books of Ansab were not really important Islamically. They were interesting because the Arabs wanted to know who they were descended from, and they wanted to sort of compete with one another about who had the better descent. They also were important because that's how they divided up the spoils of war from the Islamic conquest, was actually by your genealogy. So if your grandfather became Muslim very early on, you were going to get a big check in the mail every month, basically. And then so these were important also politically, but not really Islamically. They weren't religiously important. Tafsir in the early Islamic period isn't what we think of now. Now when we look at a book of tafsir, the author is going to tell us what the verses mean, what their legal implications are, what their theological implications are. In the early period, tafsir was really just, what does a Quranic word mean? What does a word from the Quran mean? Or when was this verse revealed? And oftentimes this does not actually come from the Prophet. This comes from companions, this comes from successors, the generation after the companions. So because it's not from the Prophet, again, the chains of transmissions weren't that strong. Muslim scholars weren't so serious about the chains of transmission because they weren't dealing with the Prophet's words, so they weren't terrified about that sin we talked about earlier of misrepresenting the Prophet, right? And a famous early tafsir is the tafsir of Muqatil ibn Sulaiman. He died in 150, again, the same year that Abu Hanifa died. But you also have in tafsir very reliable hadiths, right? So when we talk about the first verse of the Quran that was revealed to the Prophet, Surat Al-Alaq, and this is a very reliable story, right? We all know this is something that is, you know, very well established in our religion. And finally, stories about the prophets, Qasas al-Anbiya. Stories about pre-Islamic prophets, Noah, Moses, pre-Islamic Arab prophets like Shu'aib and Saleh, the people of Ad and Thamud. These also are collected into books in the early Islamic period. Some of them come from the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam. When the Prophet tells you about Noah or about Hud, right? That's true. If the Prophet says it, we know it's true. And if we have a reliable chain of transmission for it, then we know that the Prophet actually said it. Of course, we also have a lot of stories that come from non-prophetic sources, from early, let's say, Jews and Christians who converted to Islam and who brought with them their traditions into the Islamic tradition. Those are not necessarily reliable, and Muslims shouldn't base their religion on them. So the seerah, when you think about the seerah, takes from the traditions of genealogy, it takes from stories about the battles of the Prophet and the campaigns of the Muslims, it takes from tafsir, because a lot of times seerah will talk about in what context a certain Quranic verse was revealed, or, you know, the Prophet was having a certain argument with the Meccans, or having a certain argument with the Jews in Medina, and then this verse is revealed and it answered the questions. And it takes from Qasas al-Anbiya, because the Prophet will tell stories about earlier prophets. Hadith really comes from two specific things. It comes from ahkam, which we haven't talked about yet, because ahkam doesn't really have any historical importance. Ahkam means rulings. This means, how did the Prophet pray? How did he say to fast? How did he tell you to put your shoes on? Should you drink standing up, or should you drink sitting down? You know, how does a judge rule in the case of somebody when there's two competing witnesses who have different testimony? These are the things that are the basis of our practice, how we pray, how we fast, how we get married, how we get divorced, how a Muslim judge should handle disputes. They're not really going to make a historical book very interesting. You're not going to learn anything about the life of the Prophet. You're not going to learn anything about the development of the early Muslim community. So these things don't really go into the seerah, but they do form the core of the hadith books and the hadith tradition, because the hadith are there to explain to us the Quran and its meaning. And of course, also hadith books also include stories about earlier prophets and earlier communities. They also include tafsir, because If a tafsir report tells us about the meaning, the legal meaning of a Quranic verse, we have to know it in order to know what the Prophet God meant by that verse, right? But of course, when we talk about tafsir in other books, oftentimes it's, you know, someone like Umar ibn al-Khattab or someone like Urwa ibn al-Zubair from the generation of the successors who's talking about the meaning of the Quranic verse. A hadith book will always be about the Prophet's, alayhi salatu wasalam, about the Prophet's interpretation of that Quranic verse. So, one of the definitions of a hadith book is that, one, so that we can think about two general definitions. One, that it will have a generally reliable chain of transmission. And a hadith book, the scholars include the chains of transmission, the isnads, because they want to be able to show that the hadith is reliable. Or they might not be sure that it's reliable, but they want to have the isnad there anyway so that the reader knows where this material is coming from. Or so that the author of the book can tell you, here's a hadith, it's interesting for the topic, I'm not sure it's reliable, but I want you to know where it came from so that someone later on can analyze it. Second, a hadith book will include things that the Prophet said, as opposed to companions, as opposed to successors, as opposed to pre-Islamic figures. So when you open up the Sirah of Ibn Ishaq, what you'll find is that many of the stories in there actually don't come from, there's no isnad, there's no source. It's just a story about the Prophet that Ibn Ishaq heard and that he included in the book. Doesn't mean it's not true, it just means that there's no isnad and we can't really evaluate it as historians. Second, there's a lot of stories that in the Sirah that have nothing to do with the Prophet. Things that happened 20 or 30 years before he was born in Yemen or in Ethiopia. They're interesting to know the background of his life, and important and essential to know the background of his life and career, but they're not actually things that we're going to base our religion on. The second important thing to remember when we study hadith is to know how the hadith tradition developed. Hadith tradition developed very organically. Very organic tradition. It's a very common sense tradition. Okay, so imagine we're living during the time of the Prophet, and the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam has just died. Okay, suddenly this conduit, this medium we had between this earthly world and God is gone. There's no longer somebody we can turn to who can tell us what God wants from us. What action is pleasing or displeasing to God. There's no one. The Quran is stopped. There's no more answers from God. What does the community do? How does the community address this problem? Well, they look at the Quran, and of course they think about the way that the Prophet acted. They think about the things he said. Now, during the time of the Prophet, there was not an official source. There was not an official stenographer or secretary who was writing down everything the Prophet said. The Prophet got up this morning at 7 a.m. The Prophet then went and took a bath. The Prophet then did this and that. The Prophet then said this and that. His career, you know, he had secretaries who would write down Quranic revelations, right? But it was really up to different members of the community, different Muslims, to record their own recollections of what the Prophet said. Now, another thing to remember, during the time of the Prophet, there's no paper. Paper, i.e. material that you write on that comes from wood and that's pretty cheap, relatively, doesn't appear until the late 700s, and the Muslims get it from China. Before that, what did you have to write on? You had papyrus, which is very expensive. You had parchment, which is treated animal skin, which is very expensive, right? I mean, how many rabbits can you kill and skin and write on? You can't have all the books you buy from Barnes & Noble and have them written on rabbit skin. You can imagine how there wouldn't be any rabbits left. They wrote on the bones, the shoulder blades of camels. They wrote around the a palm frond, so at the base of a palm frond there's this cylindrical stick like this, and you write along the edges along a cylinder, so you write actually on the edge of the cylinder. You can't really write very much, right? No, you can't. And so a lot of the recollections that companions of the Prophet would write about him were very temporary, they weren't permanent, they weren't very comprehensive. Most of the stuff they heard from him they remembered in their minds, right? Just like, you know, we remember things our grandparents told us, we remember things our parents told us, we remember things our teachers have told us. And some of these notebooks, I use notebooks because I can't really think of a better word, these sort of ad hoc, not very formal collections were called sahifas. And they could be written on anything. Wood, parchment, palm fronds. These are some of the earliest collections of what the Prophet said and what he did. And a good example of one of these is something from, he's actually a successor. He studied with the companions of the Prophet, named Hammam ibn Munabbah. He died around 132 of the Hijri calendar. And also we know certain companions had Munabbahs. Sahifas. Ali ibn Abi Talib had one. Jabir ibn Abdullah had one. Amr ibn ibn al-As had one. Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As had one. Thank you. Samar ibn Jundub had one. And it's very interesting that the major companions, most of them didn't have sahifas. For example, Abu Bakr didn't have one, right? Omar didn't have one. Because I think the major companions, people who spent a lot of time with the Prophet, for him, their memory of the Prophet was really how he acted. They had absorbed so much of his sunnah that they didn't really think about things he said. They had just become kind of vessels of his sunnah, in a sense. And it was really the younger companions, like Abu Huraira, who only knew the Prophet for 3 years. Someone like Ibn Abbas, he was only 9 years old when the Prophet died, right? Ibn Omar was only about 22, 23 years old when the Prophet died. They hadn't spent much of their adult life around the Prophet. Yet, Abu Huraira, Ibn Omar, Ibn Abbas, these are some of the biggest transmitters of hadith from the Prophet. And the reason why, I think, is that they're like, you know, sometimes when you get older and you start thinking about your grandparents, and maybe you only knew your grandparents for a few years, you start getting really curious about what they said and what their life was about, and you start collecting things that they left behind. Maybe your parents don't really care about that so much, because your parents, they remember their parents from when they were alive for over decades of their lives. Whereas the younger generation kind of goes back and starts trying to scavenge and find all those traces of that figure who's now gone. From the Sahifa stage, we find in the early Islamic period, around the 100 years after the death of the Prophet, the development of something called Musannafs. A Musannaf is a collection of reports that is topically arranged. And a Musannaf is basically a transcript of the early stages of Islamic law and theology. So, imagine someone like Al-Hasan al-Basri. He died 110 of the Hijri calendar, 728 of the Miladi calendar. And he's sitting in Basra. Now, Hasan al-Basri's mother was one of the maids of one of the wives of the Prophet. Al-Hasan al-Basri grew up in Medina for a long time. He met and was able to study with people like Ali ibn Abi Talib. And then he moved to Basra later on in his life. So, and where he became a leading religious figure, people turned to him because he was knowledgeable, because he was pious. And you can imagine him, he's sitting there, let's say he's sitting under a reed awning, he's just minding his own business, and people are coming up to him every day. Oh, Hassan al-Basri, how should I pray? Oh, Hassan al-Basri, my wife tells me that I'm not spending enough money on her. How much money do I have to spend on her? Oh, Hassan al-Basri, my son's not listening to me. I don't know how I should handle this situation. Oh, Hassan al-Basri, there's this new drink I saw. It's made from this fruit. I've never seen it before. Am I allowed to drink it or not? Right? And he's thinking, he's trying to answer these questions. He's thinking about the Quran. He's thinking about things that he heard from the Prophet, from his mother maybe, things that he learned from Ali ibn Abi Talib, different ways of solving problems. And he's drawing on all these sources in his mind to answer these questions. A Musannaf is basically that kind of reasoning laid out in a book form. So you open a Musannaf, for example, a very famous Musannaf is the Muwatta of Malik ibn Anas. Malik ibn Anas died 179 of the Hijri calendar, 796 of the Common Era. He lived in Medina. So he studied with successors, people who studied with the companions, people like Az-Zuhri. He studied with major scholars in Medina. Right? He saw the way the people in Medina were acting, how they were praying, how they carried on the sunnah of the Prophet. And in his Muwatta, you have about 1,720 reports. Only 527 of them are actually hadiths. So only 527 of them actually go back to the Prophet, where the Prophet says, do this, don't do this, right? The rest of them are reports from companions, like Omar ibn al-Khattab. Omar ibn al-Khattab saying, I think the ruling for divorce is this. Or Omar or Abu Bakr saying, I think the right way to divide up inheritance is this. And many of them come from earlier scholars in Medina. People like Ibn Hurmuz, people like Rabi' al-Ra'i, people like Az-Zuhri, people like Urwa ibn al-Zubayr. Also Malik's own opinions. Malik says, well, I think the right way to pray is this. Or I think the right time to pray Maghrib is this time. So, just like I talked about earlier, that someone like Al-Hasan al-Basri is going to be drawing on all these varied sources as he tries to answer questions to people when they come to him asking, how do I live as a Muslim? What's the way to live that's going to please God? Right? He draws on all these things, so the Musannafs draw on these different sources. It's interesting because if you think about the Musannafs, they're not really hadith collections. They have hadiths in them, but most of the stuff is actually from companions and successors. Now, you can ask a question, wait a second, I thought Islam was about following the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet. Why does it matter what Omar ibn al-Khattab said? Or why does it matter what Malik said? It's important to remember that in this early period, the hadith tradition is very localized. What does that mean? Malik lived in Medina his whole life. He only ever went to Hajj. He went to Mecca for Hajj. He never left Medina. Other companions of the Prophet moved over to Kufa, like Ibn Mas'ud, and lived in Kufa. So what happened is, different companions took their different recollections of the Prophet's Sunnah to different cities. And they didn't really mix until later on, until the 800s of the Common Era, the time of people like Ibn Hanbal. So Malik might answer a question based on, let's say, what Omar's opinion was, or what his own opinion was. And there might be a hadith in Kufa, or in Syria, or in Egypt, he just doesn't know about. That's why he doesn't give a hadith. And many of the answers that he uses to write the book, his Muwatta, actually don't come from the Prophet, because at that time, the hadith tradition was very localized, and people just didn't have access to material that was in other regions. What happened in the next generation after people like Malik ibn Anas in the end of the 700s, the early 800s of the Common Era, is that people started traveling between the different cities. People from Basra would go to Iraq and go to Iran and go to Egypt and go to Yemen and start collecting all the different hadiths together. Now, imagine if you're somebody, let's say, that's a good example. A scholar named Abu Dawood al-Tayalisi, who died in 820 of the Common Era. So he's originally from near Isfahan, right? And he traveled in Iran, he travels all around to Egypt, to Yemen, to Mecca and Medina, to Syria. And he's collecting hadiths. How do you organize these hadiths? How do you just put them together? How do you begin to start figuring out what's reliable and what's unreliable by looking at the isnad? Well, you organize it by the isnad. So the Musannafs were organized topically. So I want to know how to pray. So I open the book to the first chapter, which is on, or the second chapter probably, which is on prayer. And I look at the different sub-chapters and I say, okay, this is how the author thinks I should pray. These are how the different companions think I should pray. When the next generation isn't really concerned about these legal issues, they're just trying to collect all these different hadiths together and trying to figure out which ones are reliable and which ones aren't. So they organize it by isnad. This is what's the beginning of what's called the Musnad collections, or Hadith collections that are organized by Isnads. So, the first chapter usually is, let's say, all the Hadiths of Abu Bakr. The second chapter is all the Hadiths narrated from Omar. Third chapter, all the Hadiths narrated from Uthman, etc., etc., etc. Another feature of Musnad collections is that by this time, Muslim scholars realize that if you're going to have a vision of Islamic law, which is bigger than just certain regions. So Malik said, this is how we do things in Medina. And Abu Hanifa talked about, this is the Kufan understanding of Islamic law. When these scholars traveled between the different cities, what they realized is, someone in Medina says X, someone in Kufa says Y. We need something that's bigger than this. We need a source that we can go back to that everybody is going to agree on. We need everything to be rooted in the hadiths of the Prophet. The Sunnah of the Prophet has to be the ultimate authority. So, hadith collections from this point on, from the early 800s onward, are only prophetic hadiths, only hadiths of the Prophet. Every once in a while, they'll include a companion opinion, maybe to clarify a hadith, to add a little bit of extra information. But from this point on, scholars realize that you have to be using prophetic reports, hadith that go back to the Prophet in order to make arguments. A good example of a musnad is the musnad of Ahmad ibn Hanbal. He died in 241 of the Hijri calendar, 855 of the Common Era. And his musnad was gigantic. It's about 27,000 hadiths. Now, it's important to remember, anywhere from one-fourth to one-third of that is repetitions. You can imagine that hadith about God descending to the lowest heaven during the night. You have maybe five versions of that in the book. So it's the same tradition, but there's a lot of different narrations. Ahmad ibn Hanbal chose these 27,000 narrations from about 750,000 narrations. But it's important to remember that the Musnad of Ahmad ibn Hanbal, it's not an authentic hadith collection. There's many hadiths in it that are unreliable, that the author included maybe because he thought they were important just to take into consideration in a legal issue, but maybe he doesn't think that this really represents the Prophet's sunnah. Oops. The next stage is the Sunan and Sahih movement. And this is, I think, what most people think about when they think of hadiths. These are books like the famous six books, the Sahih of al-Bukhari and Muslim, the Sunan of Abu Dawud, the Sunan of at-Tirmidhi, the Sunan of Ibn Majah. These are books that combine the Musannaf and the Musnad traditions into one. So they say, okay, we're going to only give you hadiths that are from the Prophet, so that you know that everyone is kind of going to agree on these as common proofs. But it's not really useful for someone to look at a book that's organized by isnad. Okay, here's all the hadiths of Abu Bakr, here's all the hadiths of Omar, but there could be hadiths on prayer in both of these chapters. Well, how do I find all the hadiths on prayer? So these books are organized topically. So there's a book, the first book is usually on tahara, on how you do wudu, and then on prayer, and then on Jummah prayer, and then on prayer of the traveling person, and then on the prayer of, then the next one is on Hajj, and the next one is on marriage, and the next one is on divorce, etc., etc. So these are topically organized. In addition to which, in this stage, the authors are trying to give you books that they feel really represent the Sunnah of the Prophet. So in the Musannaf books, you have prophetic hadiths, companion opinions, maybe contradictory companion opinions. I mean, it's sort of a whole mishmash of all the different information that was going on in Islamic law at the time. The Musnad collections, as I said before, they oftentimes include very unreliable hadiths because they're sort of like the big notebook that a scholar is stuffing everything into as he travels between Yemen and Syria, and he's just hearing hadith, stuff them into his musnad. Hearing another hadith, stuff it into his musnad. And there's probably a lot of stuff in there that he doesn't actually think is reliable, but this is sort of his big suitcase of hadiths that he's later on going to go and analyze. Once that analysis is done, you get something like the Sunan and Sahih books. So two of the famous six books, the Sahihain of al-Bukhari Muslim, are books of hadiths that their authors feel are authentic. They are the highest level of reliability in terms of their attribution to the Prophet. That means that they have chains of transmission that the authors feel are the most reliable form of authentication for figuring out if something was said or done by the Prophet. The other books in the famous six-book collection, let's say the Sunan of at-Tirmidhi, the Sunan of Abu Dawud, the Sunan of an-Nasa'i, they include hadiths that have unreliable isnads, but the author still thinks this represents the Sunnah of the Prophet. How is this? I'll explain. There's a hadith that says that water, if it reaches the amount of two kullatain, like basically, you know those barrels of oil you see? Those are oil barrels. Basically that much water. If it gets to be this much water, then it can't become najis. It can't become impure. Even if, you know, like a dog drinks from it, it's a big enough body of water that it's not going to become impure. You can still use it to do wudu, you can still drink it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you look at this hadith, all the different versions, there is no actual authentic isnad for this hadith. Okay? But there's so many different isnads, and so many Muslim scholars acted on this hadith that it's the practice of the community that guarantees the authenticity of the hadith. Right? So you can imagine, let's say I tell everybody as you leave this talk, tonight, everybody, every night before they go to bed, they need to pat themselves on the head like this, right? Now, maybe no one is ever going to really be able to trace this reliably back to me, but from now on, throughout the Anaheim area, all Muslims are going to do this, pat themselves on the head before they go to bed every night, right? So even though there's no reliable chain of transmission, everybody knows I said this, because the practice of the community guarantees the reliability of this. So when people say that there are unreliable hadiths in things like the Sunan of At-Tirmidhi or the Sunan of Abu Dawud, they're unreliable in the sense that the isnad has a problem. But the author includes them in the book because they say, even if the isnad isn't perfect, the jurists of the Muslim community have genuinely acted on this hadith. In addition to which, I won't go into that. It's not important. Something that's very interesting is people tend to think that, okay, Bukhari and Muslim, who lived in the mid-800s, Bukhari died 870, Muslim, his student, died 875 of the Common Era, Abu Dawud, Tirmidhi, Nasa'i, these were all in the same generation as Bukhari and Muslim. Well, once their work is done, really, that's it, right? I mean, we have the Sahihain, we have the six books, we have a reliable body of hadith, so I guess, you know, we can just move on and work on something else, you know, move on to a different project. This is not true at all. The biggest collections of hadith come after that. The biggest collections of hadith come in the 900s of the Common Era, even in the 1000s, 200 years after the work of al-Bukhari and Muslim. The one famous scholar, we talked about him already, al-Tabarani from Esfahan, he died in 971 of the Common Era. His hadith collection is 28 printed volumes. So Bukhari's book, maybe two or three volumes, 28 printed volumes. There was a scholar named Al-Masarjisi from Iran. He died in about 975 of the Common Era. His book doesn't exist anymore because no one had the courage to copy it. It would be 180 printed volumes. 180 printed volumes. Now, these hadiths, these books often just were full of absolutely unreliable hadiths. Hadiths that were, unreliable, no one was going to use them, they oftentimes had nothing to do with law. And you can ask yourself, and I want you to ask yourself because we'll answer in the next slide, why would people do this? If they already had these very reliable books of hadith, Abu Dawud, for example, in his one of his letters, he says about his sunan, he says, if you have my sunan and you have the Quran, you don't need to learn anything after this. You have the Quran, you have my sunan, that's it. You don't need to learn anything after this. But what you see after the era of the six books is that Muslims start using hadiths for totally different reason. And I will talk about this now. The first function of hadith is the one that we've been dealing with so far. Hadith is a tool or a piece of information that tells us about how to act, what to believe, what's right and what's wrong. This is generally what people think about hadith, right? When they think about what the purpose of hadith is. The interesting thing about hadith is that after the time of the six books, they start taking on a very different role. They become a medium of connection to the Prophet and a means of excellence and precedence in the scholarly community. This is very complicated language. Let me explain what it means. Imagine you're a Muslim scholar or you're a student and you're trying to learn and become a great scholar. What are the ways that you can show that you're, let's say, have a lot of connections to teachers? What's the way you're going to build up your CV? People use hadiths to build up their CV. So if you were able to, let's say, travel widely and hear hadiths from lots of different teachers in Egypt and Iran and in what's now Afghanistan and Yemen, then you can have a little hadith collection where you collect one hadith from every single one of your teachers. This is called Mu'jam al-Shuyukh, a collection of hadith where you have one hadith from every one of your teachers. Does it really matter if those hadiths are authentic or not? No, because the purpose of this hadith collection is not to be legal collection. This is to show all the different places I've been and all the different people I've studied with. And it makes you look even better if you have hadiths nobody else has. Or if you have a shorter isnad than anybody else. Because you can imagine that the isnad is what connects you to the Prophet, right? The Prophet, what connects you to God ultimately. It connects you to the blessing of the Prophet, to his barakah. So, the less degrees of separation, the closer you are to the Prophet. And getting short isnads, or what's called Ali isnads, elevated isnads, becomes something that Muslim scholars try to do so that they can feel close to the Prophet. And also, like with CVs, they also, you know, it's kind of a way of showing that you're more accomplished, or have more teachers, or you're more pious than other people. As you can see, none of this really has anything to do with the actual function of hadith as something we use to know about our belief and our law as Muslims. It has to do with how Muslim scholars create their own scholarly culture. Remember, in Islam, you don't have a priesthood, right? So how is it that people know when they are inducted into that group of people, the ulama, who have the right to interpret Islamic law and dogma? One of the ways is by having their own connection that goes back to the Prophet. And so what we find in some of these later hadith collections, I talked about a Tabarani, remember? He died in 971, he's a guy from Esfahan. His book is, his big mu'jam is 28 volumes. In one of his books, he has an isnad of three people between him and the Prophet. Two people, sorry, wait, three. He heard from a guy named Ja'far bin Humaid, who heard from his grandfather, who saw Anas ibn Malik, the companion of the Prophet, teach him how to do wudu. So that's Ja'far bin Humaid, his grandfather, to Anas bin Malik. So, yes, I see. So he's a Tabarani, he's living in Esfahan in the middle of the 900s. He lived to be around 100 years old. He started learning hadith when he was 13 years old. So he has these this isnad of only three people back to the Prophet. Now, that hadith is totally unreliable. Okay? Nobody ever heard of this guy Ja'far ibn Humaid. No one ever heard of his grandfather. Right? How can you be living in the 900s and you're basically three people away from the Prophet? This is, Bukhari's book has 28 isnads in it that are three people long. And Bukhari was living 100 years before that. You know, if you look at the Sunan of At-Tirmidhi or the Sahih of Muslim, you'll never find hadith that are with three people in the isnad. Maybe four people. But this guy's living 100 years later, he has a three-person isnad? Okay. Now, if his last student died around 1038 of the Common Era, he had a student who was a woman who died at around 520 of the Common Era. Sorry, about 1120 of the Common Era, right? So if you were living in about the middle of the 1100s, you heard this woman give her isnad to her teacher, to a Tabarani, through this three-person isnad, you would be living with 6 degrees of separation from the Prophet in the 1100s, right? So you're basically 500 years later with 6 degrees of separation from the Prophet. You can just imagine the sense of closeness that this gives people and sort of pride in their scholarly accomplishments. And of course, this hadith is not reliable. The isnad is not reliable. It becomes like a collector's item. It becomes like a collector's item. When someone collects coins, does it really matter what the original worth of the coin is? If I have a penny that's really rare, I don't really care that a penny is worth nothing. The point is that it's really rare. And the point is, and that's what makes me proud of it. Another very interesting thing is when you have hadiths narrated by jinn, right? Because this, again, you have people, for example, the famous author of the dictionary, Taj al-Arus, Murtada Zabidi, he died 1791. He's originally from India, he moved to Cairo. He heard from a jinn, who heard from another jinn, who heard from the Prophet. So he had only two people in the Islam. They're just jinn. That's fine. Now, no one is ever going to act on that because Muslim scholars don't accept jinn transmission when it comes to law. So if you meet a jinn and he tells you, by the way, you don't have to pray 5 times a day. That's just a big, I don't know how this happened. It was a big misunderstanding. I heard the Prophet say you don't have to pray 5 times a day. You can't listen to the jinn because jinn transmissions are not admissible in law. It's something that Muslim scholars sort of kept around as this tradition of connection to the Prophet. Okay. I wanted to, first of all, have people ask questions. And then if you wanted, I can narrate a hadith to you, and then you guys can all have a chain of transmission back to the Prophet. So if you want that, I can do it. Might get a little boring. There's a lot of names. But if it's something you want, I'd be happy to do it. It's a tradition for scholars to do this. And but I think first I'll answer questions, because I don't want to take up time without answering questions that I may have generated. Yes, go ahead. So the question is, what are the differences between Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim? There's two very important differences. Remember, Muslim was a student of al-Bukhari, right? One of the main differences is the nature of the books. Sahih al-Bukhari is kind of the gospel according to Bukhari. This is his vision of Islamic law and dogma. He gives you a chapter. He tells you, this is the title of the chapter. This is what you should understand from the chapter. The hadith that I'm giving you as my evidence. It's almost like his version of Islam, right? Muslim's book is much more of almost a reference, in the sense that Muslim will give you a chapter that's saying, these are the things that if they pass in front of you, will break your prayer. It's a dog or a donkey, for example, or someone walking too close in front of you. The next chapter will be, here are hadiths that tell you that nothing that passes in front of you will break your prayer. So, if you're reading the book, it doesn't really help you understand how to pray, because you have two chapters that contradict one another. Because what Muslim is saying is, I'm just giving you hadiths that I think are authentic. How you put them together is the business of a jurist, right? So let's say in the Sunan of at-Tirmidhi, you have a chapter that says hadiths that tell you you can drink standing up. The next chapter is hadiths that the Prophet prohibited people from drinking standing up. So how do you, as a jurist, what do you do? Well, you say, the Prophet, we know that he drank standing up, so it was allowed, but we have these reports of him saying you shouldn't do it, so it's probably makruh. It's allowed, but it's not recommended. Right? So this is the difference between Bukhari and Muslim's books in terms of their actual format. The difference in their methodologies is very, very specific scholarly issue. In general, Muslim scholars believe that Bukhari required everybody in his chain of transmission to have met their teacher at least once. Let me rephrase that. He required there be evidence that he met his teacher or she met her teacher at least once. So there has to be some instance, some hadith, where, let's say, Uthman says, Jonathan Brown told me, I heard him say, or he narrated to me. Everything else might be Jonathan Brown said. But when someone says Jonathan Brown said, that doesn't mean they actually heard me say it. It means maybe they heard somebody else attribute it to me. Or they read it in the newspaper, right? It doesn't mean they actually had to hear it from me. What Bukhari says is, we have to know that at least once in his life, this student had to have actually met his teacher. That way we know that, in general, the different hadiths that they transmit from one another took place from face-to-face transmission. A Muslim, in his Sahih, he says, this is really unrealistic because there's so many relationships between transmitters that we use all the time. For example, Urwa ibn Zubair from Aisha. Right? So Urwa ibn Zubair, the son of Abdullah ibn Zubair, was basically adopted by Aisha. But she sort of adopted him because he was her niece. Sorry, he was her nephew by his mother. So she kind of adopted him almost as a child. And Urwa ibn Zubair spent tons of time with her. But, and I think, I don't want to misquote Muslim, I think this is the case. If I'm wrong, then forgive me, someone can check this up. I think Muslim says, there's never actually an instance where Urwa ibn Zubair says, I heard Aisha say. He says, Aisha said. Now, we assume, because he spent so much time with her, that that he heard this from her in person. But if we look at that methodology that Bukhari is using, it's actually it's tough to actually prove that he heard this from her. So what he's trying to do is he's saying Bukhari's, and he never actually mentions al-Bukhari. Maybe it's because he's his teacher, he doesn't want to be disrespectful. Maybe it was that Bukhari never thought that. But he says, I don't agree with this because basically if we apply this rule, then all these chains of transmission that we know are authentic by our methodology, we'd actually have to reject them. It's too demanding. So that's the big difference between Bukhari and Muslim. There's a couple of other differences. Bukhari generally doesn't take from, Muslim doesn't take from, what was it, say Muhammad? Ikrimah, the bondsman of Abdullah bin al-Abbas, because he thinks that Ikrimah is a Kharijite, whereas Bukhari doesn't mind taking from Ikrimah. There's a couple of other disagreements. Muslim takes from Marwan ibn al-Hakam. Bukhari does not take from Marwan ibn al-Hakam. He was sort of a controversial figure who was maybe not the best Muslim. He was a successor, not a companion of the Prophet. Does that answer the question? Okay. Other questions? Yes.
You mentioned that one of the ways to legitimize or accept the hadith, if it's widespread, if there's widespread practice mm-hmm. in a certain community, was there a distinction made whether there's a certain generation that the practice was widespread in, or if it's a certain region like Medina, as opposed to newer communities that they were coming in the fold of Islam?
This is a good question. The question is, when we talk about communal practice, sort of authenticating hadith, is there any limit on that? Yes, obviously, if today all Muslims are, I don't know, let's say all Muslims are dishonest and, you know, objectionable or something, that doesn't mean that there's a hadith that says be dishonest and objectionable, that's authentic. Right? So, I mean, clearly Muslim practice today does not have the authority that it had at the time of the Prophet or the early generations of Muslims. In addition to which, I don't think you're going to have any agreement amongst Muslims nowadays that you didn't have in the early period. So when people talk about that communal practice validating a hadith, it's usually you're talking about the first couple of generations of Islam. It just doesn't happen after that. It's not going to be realistic. For someone like Malik ibn Anas, he felt he was from Medina. He felt that the practice of the people of Medina reflected the sunnah of the Prophet. So he felt that the communal practice of Medina was particularly authoritative. These were the people whom the Prophet had taught Islam firsthand. And they had taught their children Islam as they learned it from the Prophet. So when Malik says, I pray with my hands down at my side, because this is how we pray in Medina, his attitude is, who cares if someone comes from Kufa or from Syria telling me that I have to have my hands like this? I've lived here my whole life. I saw my father pray like this, who learned from the companions of the Prophet. Everybody prays like this. This is the sunnah of the Prophet, not what somebody from Damascus or from Egypt is telling me. Right? So he felt that the sunnah of the people of Medina really represented the sunnah of the Prophet. Other Muslims from other cities said, I don't agree. Someone like his student, Ashafi, said, where do we get the idea? Where is the basis for this belief that the people of Medina have somehow more authority than everyone else? And Shafi will say, the people of Medina disagree on things. They don't all agree on everything. So since whose opinion is more authoritative than the other people within Medina? So that specific belief of the Maliki Madhhab was not accepted by the other Muslim schools of law, who thought that you couldn't just use one city's practice to be authoritative, even if it was Medina. So the question is, if when you have the sort of six books, the Sunan and Sahih books, if that sort of accomplishes the goal of hadith, why are there more hadith collections being generated? And those hadiths that are collected later on, did the earlier people know they existed? That's a very good question. In part, they didn't know they existed maybe because they were, just like in the early period, later on, one, a lot of the hadiths were not actually very reliable. So in Tirmidhi's book, he'll say, here's a hadith on this issue. And there's also other hadiths from so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. He won't list those hadiths because for him, they're just not worth listing. They're not reliable enough. Those hadiths are the ones that appear in later books like Tabarani and Bayhaqi and things like that. So the earlier scholars knew they existed, but they weren't really reliable enough to include in their books. And those are the ones that later scholars picked up on. Does that make any sense? Does that answer your question? Okay. So I'll stop now, so I'll get no more objections on azan talk.
All right, jazakallah khair.